prizes, which include the Eddington Medal, the Royal Society Medal, the Wolf Foundation Prize, the Dirac Medal, the Albert Einstein Medal, the Naylor Prize, the De Morgan Medal, and the Copley Medal. He was elected as a Fellow of the Royal Society in 1972, and he was knighted in 1994. In 2000, he was appointed to the Order of Merit, which is an interesting thing. It has only 24 members at any given time, which includes the former Canadian Prime Minister, John Chrétien, the former British Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, the playwright Tom Stoppard, and Lucien Freud, who's a famous artist. It also includes Nelson Mandela as an honorary member. Roger played a very important role in the early days of Perimeter Institute by serving on the Scientific Advisory Committee, and his advice played a very important role in shaping the institute that we have today. He gave the very first lecture in the public lecture series. Last time he gave a public lecture in this series, it was on the front page of the Globe and Mail the following day. He's giving another lecture in this public lecture series tonight, and apparently the tickets for that sold out in under 4 minutes, which is a new record, probably the envy of many rock stars. Roger has made contributions to almost all subject areas represented at Perimeter: general relativity, foundations of quantum theory, quantum gravity, cosmology, and his Twister program has in recent years been taken up by string theorists. Today he's going to speak on conformal cyclic cosmology, equations of evolution, observational consequences. Please.
Well, thank you very much, Lucien. It's certainly very nice to be back here. And that's not quite the title of my talk, but it would do. Since I couldn't remember what it was, you can either take that one or another one, which is not the title, namely that one. But anyway, you get the idea what I'm talking about. First of all, let me just remind people what the universe looks like. This is meant to be a cartoon of the universe with time going up the picture, which is what my pictures will tend to be, have this time going upwards. Four-dimensional pictures, of course, you have trouble drawing all four dimensions here. You might notice this funny business going around the back. That's just because I don't want to be prejudiced with regard to which of these spatial geometries is relevant, either the flat case, which seems to be very close to being flat, the hyperbolic case, or the closed spherical case. I have this picture for a different reason, which I'll come back to later on, which is important for the talk. I should also comment about this down here. I hope you can read that. The question is whether I put inflation in the picture. Well, maybe I have, maybe I haven't. You can't tell from this picture. But the reason I haven't represented it is partly that if I did, you wouldn't see it because it would be tucked right in there. And the other reason is that I don't really believe it. And the scheme I want to talk about, in some respects, is an alternative to inflation. Now, one of the main reasons why we believe in the Big Bang, of course, is the microwave background, this radiation coming in from all directions at about 2.7 degrees absolute. And two features about that, which I'm going to stress at the beginning, the two most blatant features, are, first of all, as illustrated here, the fact that the spectrum of the radiation is extraordinarily close to a Planck spectrum. In fact, you see we have these error bars here, which are all exaggerated by a factor of about 500, which means that even the worst case down here, if you divide that by 500, you'll get an error bar which is so small that you can't distinguish the data points from the thickness of the ink for the exact Planck curve. So this is extremely precise. And then you say, what does that indicate? Well, it indicates thermal equilibrium. And that is, in a certain sense, a puzzle, because what we have to understand, and one of the driving forces behind the arguments that I'm going to give, is the second law of thermodynamics. And the second law of thermodynamics tells us that entropy is going up, which means that if you go back in time, entropy must be going down. And if you find at the beginning something which looks like thermal equilibrium, you would have a paradox if it weren't for the fact that you're not only looking at matter and radiation in equilibrium, and what you're not looking at is gravity. In fact, you are looking at gravity if you think about the other aspect of the microwave background, the other most obvious aspect, which is the uniformity over the sky. The temperature is almost exactly the same, at least it is if you correct for the dipole that you get because the Earth is moving through it, and therefore it's slightly hotter in the direction we're moving towards, and so, I don't know whether it's that direction or that one or wherever, but let me point that way anyway. The direction which we're moving towards or the direction we're moving away from, and you compensate for that and you find that the temperature is very close to being uniform to something like a part or so in 10 to the 5. So it's very closely uniform over the sky. And that's telling us something else. The spatial uniformity would be completely consistent. No, I have to make sure if I'm covering something up, I have to do this way up, don't I? With this kind of machine. If we have, say, a gas in a box, then if you imagine it tucked up in one corner to begin with, and then you open the compartment, and then it spreads out over the whole box, then it will look very uniform. So that's consistent with high entropy as far as matter is concerned, unless you take into account gravity. And this is the issue which is important here, that everything except gravity, as far as one can tell, you have a very high entropy state in the initial universe, whereas gravity itself, because when you clump material, it tends to make the entropy go up. Gravity itself is uniform, like the distribution of the radiation, but what that is telling you is that as far as gravity is concerned, it's very special. Lee Smolin had a nice way of saying this recently, to say that you seem to have two temperatures in the early universe. One is the very, very high temperature of the matter, and the other is the very, very low temperature of gravity. And that has always struck me as a huge puzzle. I've always been puzzled also by the fact that cosmologists as a whole don't seem to be puzzled by it in the sense of regarding it as a great puzzle which has to be explained somehow. It always seemed to me that this is something which we need to understand, not just that the entropy is low in the early universe, at least low by comparison with what it might have been, but is low in this very particular way, that it's only gravity that seems to be the way in which it's low. So what is it that singles out gravity to have this special place with regard to the second law? And that seems to be something we need to pay attention to. Of course, this picture also illustrates that when the clumping gets stronger and stronger, you tend to get black holes. And so you would tend to find, it depends on the detail sometimes, but what you tend to find is that the black hole represents the maximum entropy state. So it is a very high entropy state. And so we have to remind ourselves what black holes look like, which to relativists we need a space-time diagram for. And here, of course, we have the collapse of material. Here, time going up the picture. And here is some body which has finally collapsed down to within its horizon, which is represented here. The light cones are indicated as being tipped over so that when you get to the horizon, one side of the light cone is vertical in the picture, and so that signals originating inside this can't escape without violating the causality that's decreed by the light cone structure. In the middle, we have this singularity, and that's the standard collapse picture that we Oppenheimer and Snyder produced in the, just before the Second World War. And it seems to hold pretty well, even if you introduce perturbations. So we have a good picture of what a black hole is like. Now, of course, we don't know what happens right in the middle, and that singularity is, of course, another aspect of the problem that we had with the universe as a whole, namely the Big Bang. And we have these two types of singularity, the singularity which started the universe off, and the singularity in the black hole, which, for the, at least for the local people who've fallen into it, that's the end of the universe as far as they're concerned. That's the standard picture we have anyway. And in order to make this picture a little bit more complete then, I should introduce the black hole's singularities as well. And here we have in this picture the sort of dilemma that we're presented with. We have singularities, space-time singularities, which we're supposed to understand, and the normal view being that this is to be understood in terms of some kind of quantum gravity theory. And then the question arises, why are they so different? Because we find that these black hole singularities are in some sense extremely high entropy singularities. Black holes themselves are certainly high entropy objects. As far as we know, easily the largest entropy contribution in the present universe is in black holes. Our own galaxy has a black hole of something like 4 million times the mass of the Sun, and there are other much bigger ones around, going up to, as I understand it, something like 10 to the 10 solar masses or so. It's black holes of that kind of scale. And these easily swamp the entropy in the microwave background, which was originally thought to be remarkably high, which it is if you think of other things than black holes. But when the black holes come into the picture, they easily dominate the entropy content of the universe. I mean, we don't know whether distant galaxies also have black holes in them, but we presume that they're similar to the ones locally, and that therefore the entropy content of the universe will be largely in black holes. Now let me come back to this question of inflation, which always worried me, because it's put forward often as an argument for why the universe is so uniform, but that always worried me, because uniformity is just part of this entropy problem. I mean, okay, it's uniform, and that is the way in which the entropy seems to have been low in the early universe, but just to try and get that out of some dynamics doesn't seem to make any sense to me. So in fact, if you want to make inflation work, you more or less have to assume that the universe is very close to being Friedman, Robertson, Walker, Lemaître in the early stages, otherwise you can't even talk about inflation and make it do what it's supposed to. So, or at least part of the universe has to be like that. And in fact, the question seems to me to be not easily addressed by things like inflation, where you have, say, the inflaton field, which satisfies dynamical equations which are symmetrical in time. And so you're talking about time-symmetric physics. And so the question that you might consider is what indeed is the most likely kind of way in which the universe might have started off. And so what we can do is to turn the time around the other way and consider a universe very much like ours, but where you have irregularities that we have in the universe now, but in which you make slight changes in the microscopic details so that you don't have the correlations which would make the universe go back to where it does here, and the entropy being reduced in the process. But if you randomize the microscopic details, then you would expect something where the clumping increases as the universe collapses, black holes finally form and congeal, and you get an unbelievable mess like that, where the final singularity may well be something like the BKL picture, where you have oscillations of incredible type, Weyl curvature diverging to infinity, and so on. There is a slight point about what I'm going to say. What I'm going to say, let me do it first. See, you can put the equations of the inflaton field in as well, and it makes no difference to this picture. You will certainly get a great mess like that. And if that's the case, then the question arises, why didn't it start that way? Which would have been far more probable in terms of phase space volume. It's ridiculously more probable. You have to think in terms of the region that has to be aimed for by whoever started this thing off as being, or whatever perhaps I should say, being something like, as far as the observable universe is concerned, something like one part in 10^(10^124), or something like that. So you have to think of an incredible precision which gave us the Big Bang that we see. There is another slight detail point here which perhaps I should mention, and that is that it's a conjecture, which is the cosmic censorship conjecture, or I should say the strong cosmic censorship conjecture, that you can't really see a singularity like this until you hit it. And that is, another way of saying that is that the space-like, that the singularity in the general case should be something space-like, or possibly null, but space-like in general. And if it's space-like, then it is something that you could imagine could be regarded as an instantaneous event, because a space-like surface, you could say that surface is the beginning surface, and why wasn't it like this? So that's the question that we keep coming back to, which it seems to me is a fundamental problem, which is raised by the second law of thermodynamics and by the nature of the Big Bang. The question is, why did the Big Bang not involve any white holes? Well, you see, that's what we would get in this great mess that we see here as the possible starting point of the universe. These would be a lot of white holes. I mean, there are arguments that white holes are unstable, which, of course, that's fine. They are unstable. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't have started off. That just means they'll go away eventually. And indeed, they will. But if they were there in the beginning, producing a highly inhomogeneous initial universe, we would have noticed that. It's certainly not like that. So they weren't there in the early universe, unstable or not. So this is really the puzzle. The fundamental problem raised by the second law of thermodynamics and the nature of the Big Bang is, why did the Big Bang not involve any white holes? And those are the time-reversed black holes. And it's not answered by inflation or by any current theory of quantum gravity. So it goes, the criticism or the argument goes beyond merely thinking about inflation as an issue. It's really a deeper one with regard to what kind of physics goes on at the Big Bang, and is that something that any kind of approach to quantum gravity is likely to explain. So bear all that in mind. But for the particular approach that I want to discuss here, I want to look at the other end of the universe for a bit, namely the remote future. And in the remote future, we find that these black holes here, you have to wait a long time, but eventually the Hawking radiation from the black holes will take over. Of course, the universe is expanding, so the temperature of the, or exponentially expanding, so that the temperature will start to go down and go down to less than the temperature of black holes that we see around us. I should make the point, perhaps, that a solar mass black hole, which is perhaps the hottest black hole we know of, has a temperature which is something comparable with the lowest temperature that's ever been made on the Earth. So it's not very hot. And the bigger black holes are colder still, so we're thinking about some extremely cold objects. But these things don't remain cold by comparison with the rest of the universe when the exponential expansion takes over, and we have to think in terms of the ultimate fate of these things. Well, when the radiation gets down to less than the black hole, you will find that the Hawking radiation starts to take energy away from the black hole, and therefore mass, and then ultimately it will disappear with a pop. This pop being not worthy of the name bang, because, okay, it would be pretty nasty if it went off in this room, but it's only like a big artillery shell or something like that, which is pretty trivial from the point of view of cosmology or astrophysics, particularly when you take into account the fact that it doesn't seem to make any difference how big this hole was to begin with. It could be one of these 10 to the 10 solar mass black holes, or it could be one solar mass black hole, and it takes a lot longer if it's 10 to the 10 solar masses. And you might have to think in terms of timescales up to about a Google years, 10 to the 100 years, in order for these biggest ones to disappear. But we believe that they would disappear by Hawking evaporation, and they would just finally go off with a pop. Well, I was thinking about this picture for a while. Let me make sure I have the right one's accessible. I need to keep track of that one. Here we are. So I should make that one a bit more realistic by putting in the pops. And here we have that. This now is not to scale, because the pops take an awful long time to take place, as I mentioned. You'll notice that I've put up at the top here the very boring era. I should say it's pretty boring even before the pops, and I could hardly think of anything more boring than sitting around waiting for a black hole to go off pop. If that's the most exciting thing going on, that's not even that. That form of excitement is removed from us after that. So I was worrying about this, how boring our universe is, and using an emotional argument, which maybe people might object to using emotional arguments in science. I think there's nothing wrong with it, provided you ultimately back it up with good mathematics and observation and so on. So that's what we're trying to do here. So where are we left? You see, we're left with this very boring universe, pretty well filled with things like photons, a lot of massless stuff running around. And that gives some reason to be a little bit more optimistic, because the things which are running around are mostly things like photons, mostly photons, in fact. And these photons aren't easily bored. They're not easily bored for two reasons. One is they probably don't have any experiences, and the other is that they don't experience time, even if they did. So here we have a photon running along in this picture of the light cone, and here we have these bowl-shaped surfaces which represent the ticks of clocks. If we have two identical clocks here, and then there's the first tick and the second and the third tick, and then what we have to include into our space-time geometry, not just the light cone structure, but also the crowding of these surfaces which measure the time. And we have some extremely accurate clocks these days, nuclear clocks, atomic clocks and nuclear clocks. And the precision of those clocks ultimately comes down to these two basic formulae of 20th century physics, Planck's E equals h nu and Einstein's E equals mc squared, which if you put them together, you see that any particle, a stable particle of rest mass m, defines a frequency of oscillation, which is simply defined by these two basic formulae and the constants, the velocity of light and Planck's constant. And so matter particles are clocks, very good clocks. But if you just have massless particles, then it seems to be pretty hard to make a clock. And in fact, you have, if you just used, say, electromagnetism without mass, you wouldn't be able to build a clock, because electromagnetism is conformally invariant. And so if you have any change of scale, which could change from place to place, I'm not saying a uniform change of scale, but each point in space-time could have a different scale change made, as long as it's smooth over the whole universe. And the Maxwell equations remain consistent with that, as long as you scale things in the right way, and including the interactions with charged particles. And that applies also to all the other Yang-Mills equations. That's just as conformally invariant. The only thing which seems to break the conformal invariance are things to have to do with mass, which are either rest mass or the gravitational interaction, which does involve a conformal breaking. But if we take the view that the main physics which is going on, or the, let's for the moment say everything which is going on of importance in the very remote future, is conformally invariant, then the geometry which is relevant to these things in the universe will be the geometry of the light cones, in other words, conformal geometry, where you've taken the nine components, which are the ratios of the 10 components of metric, as the defining this geometry, and the only thing you're throwing away will be the scale factor, which gives you the full Einstein metric tensor from from the conformal nine-component object, which is the conformal geometry. And then you can do some things which you can't do when you've got metric geometry. And this goes back now to the Escher picture. This is a slightly different Escher picture, but it perhaps illustrates even better this hyperbolic geometry. The point I'm trying to make here is not that we have a representation of hyperbolic geometry, which we do. This is a very nice representation due to Beltrami. As far as I'm aware, pretty well all the representations are due to Beltrami, which just makes it a little hard to refer to them. But it's the conformal representation. The name usually assigned to this is Poincaré, who did it some years after Beltrami. But the main point I want to make, as I say, is that this nice conformal geometry is entirely represented here, including right the way out to infinity, in this finite picture in Euclidean space. And it's a conformal representation, which means that the angles are accurately represented in the background Euclidean geometry. So they say the angle on the fin of this fish is exactly as it should be, all the way right down to the edge. The eyes of the fish, which are circles here, in fact are exact circles, right down to the edge. Of course, the larger shapes, or in fact the sizes, do get distorted. But if you're only interested in conformal geometry, the conformal geometry of this infinite hyperbolic space is identical to the conformal geometry internal to that circle in the Euclidean plane. This extends to higher dimension, so you could have if you want three dimensions, you would take the hyperbolic geometry represented inside a sphere, and you would take the Euclidean space extending outside that sphere. So what I'm using this picture for here is really as a representation which shows that infinity can be a nice smooth surface. Now, this is a sort of trick that we've been using for many decades in relativity to think about how to talk about gravitational radiation and electromagnetic radiation in gravitational context. And you want to talk about things like energy loss and so on and so forth. It's really handy to be able to squash down infinity into a finite boundary. Now, you can do that in the cases where we were interested in previously, which tended to be asymptotically flat spaces. But if you have a cosmological model, when you have a positive cosmological constant, then you find that you have a surface which is space-like, right as infinity. So we got a boundary to infinity, which is infinity, and which the conformal geometry is regular right up to and including that boundary. And it's very handy in order to do calculations when you have a space with boundary, to pretend that that space continues beyond the boundary, and then you can differentiate and do all sorts of nice things. And that's just a mathematical trick, but it's a handy mathematical trick. So that's what I'm going to say here. And this trick will work in very general circumstances. There are nice theorems due to Helmut Friedrich, which tell us that it is very general. And you can put in matter as long as it's massless matter. Once the black holes have all gone off pop, then they're not around either, and they primarily emit their entire mass in the form of photons. So that will be almost photons. There'll be a little other junk going wrong right at the end. But in fact, the main problem with this whole picture is that you have particles, rogue electrons and things like that, which have never had the chance to meet up with a proton or whatever it is, or a positron. And protons, they may or may not decay, but in any case, they're supposed to retain their positive charge unless you have violations of charge conservation. And if you do have violations of charge conservation, then your photon would have to have a mass, in which case it doesn't help much. But what I want to try and say is that everything is massless right up to the end here, so that it's legitimate to think of the geometry of physics as being something which respects this conformal picture. That's the basic idea. And as I said before, I didn't say it this way, but eternity is no time at all for a photon. But what about electrons? Because there will be a number of electrons hanging around. And unless charges conservation is violated, you're going to have a problem getting rid of them. So what I'm saying, and this is in some sense the weakest argument that I'm going to give you. I don't think it's all that weak. It depends on your point of view. But what I'm going to try and argue for is that in the very, very, very long times we're thinking about, Google years, perhaps longer than that, there will be a decaying away of mass. I don't mean that the particle will decay into something massless, because that you need the massless thing there to be around to decay into. And we don't have anything massless around now. That would have shown itself. I mean, say, charged and massless. We don't have any massless charged particles. There could conceivably be a massless neutrino. I don't think that's the normal view, because the usual picture is that they all have masses, the three different types. But I think the only observations are related to the differences between masses. It's conceivable as a massless neutrino, but you can't get use that if you have a charge, which won't be annihilated generally because they can't, they'll get isolated in their horizons, and charges of the other type won't encounter them. So we have this little problem. So I'm going to say that mass probably will ultimately fade out in the remote future. It's not unlike, well, let me come back to that picture. I think there is an issue about rest mass when you have a cosmological constant anyway, because according to a standard way of analyzing particles, elementary particles, one thinks of representations of the Poincaré group, and you have the mass and the spin as being Casimir operators for the Poincaré group, and so you'd think that they have to be absolute constants for a stable particle. But if you bring in a cosmological constant, then you have the de Sitter group, and that's less clear because the Casimir operators don't include what we normally think of as mass, for instance. So there is an issue which I think needs more thinking about. That's one mathematical trick, and here's the other one. For a long time, I've talked in terms of a thing called the Weyl curvature hypothesis. You see, we may not know why the universe started off in this very special state, but at least we might try and characterize that state. What was it like? Well, I tended to say that, well, the degrees of freedom that seem to have been killed off for some reason in the early universe are gravitational degrees of freedom, and the way that I like to think of the gravitational degrees of freedom as things being measured by the Weyl curvature, the Weyl conformal curvature tensor. And that is the analog, I would say, of the Maxwell field tensor and the analog of the source term, that's the Ricci tensor in Einstein's theory, in Maxwell theory would be the charge current vector. So to say that you don't have electromagnetic degrees of freedom around would be to say that you don't have Maxwell tensor around. So what I'm saying here is to say that you don't have gravitational degrees of freedom around in the beginning, gravitational now, is that you don't have a Weyl curvature at the beginning. So that was the idea, to say that this Weyl curvature hypothesis is that the Weyl curvature should be zero, or at least something very small, in the early universe. Now this is a bit problematic, because if you have a singularity, it's a bit hard to know what you mean by a tensor. So if you want to say it's zero, you have to know what the Weyl tensor is. And if the Weyl tensor is to be, if a tensor is defined at a singular point, that can be a problem. And you're led to talking about limits and various things. Then you can take limits in different ways. And so it's a little bit obscure what this means. So it's fortunate that Paul Todd has proposed a rather more elegant way of saying this, which is to do the following. You imagine that the Big Bang is stretched out now to a finite boundary again, a three-dimensional surface this is meant to represent, and that the conformal geometry of that is extendable to something behind it. So it's very similar to what we were just talking about, but in the other direction. So it's like the Escher picture, if you like, but now we're talking about So we're thinking about stretching the Big Bang out so that you get a nice smooth surface. And again, it's a mathematical trick. And it works pretty well. It's not quite saying that the Weyl curvature is zero. In fact, you could have a finite Weyl curvature at the boundary to be consistent with this proposal of Paul Todd's. But I'm going to take this on and say, also, it's physically something to take seriously, because what do we have very close to the Big Bang? We have an extremely hot situation where particles are extremely energetic, and the energies of individual particles would be likely to be in excess of the rest mass of those particles, at least certainly as you get near to the Big Bang, and when you get down to the sort of Higgs temperatures, then you would expect rest mass earlier than that to lose its meaning. So the point of view here is that basically you have massless entities alone in the very early universe, and so as far as the contents of the universe are concerned, again, it's conformal geometry. which seems to be the relevant background for this material to exist in. So we have these two situations, the future and the past, both being smooth, possibly. And in the one case, it's something that we expect to happen naturally, as long as we don't have these rogue, too many of these rogue things around. Helmut Friedrich has shown us that this is a good mathematical situation to consider. And this thing is more like a hypothesis to characterize the particular way in which the Big Bang was special. Now, it's only just meant to be a characterization at this stage. Now, we can do both of these things at once. If you do both of them at once, then we have a picture like this, where infinity is squashed down to find a nice smooth boundary, and the Big Bang is stretched out to form a nice smooth boundary. So those are those two pictures. And now what I want to do is, see, up to this point, it's all kind of fairly reasonable. So the next step is to do a bit more outlandish about it. And to say, you say, what was it? What is it going to be that goes beyond our infinity? And what was it that was before the Big Bang? And I've drawn these pictures so that they would fit together like this. So it's conceivable. Well, the first thing you might think is maybe our remote future is conformally extendable to our Big Bang. And that's, in a sense, the neatest, because you just sort of loop around like this in this way. I don't think that works terribly well for the sorts of problems that one has when you have closed time-like curves, as you have in this case. And these closed time-like curves could, in principle, send signals. You could send those signals around them. And I'll come at the end of the talk to say something about what kind of signal might be getting across, but the very potential possibility for signals getting across certainly raises this puzzle that makes it sort of... You're putting an awful lot of constraints on the universe which would be very hard to satisfy, even apart from the science fiction paradoxes which come along here. So let's not do that. And what I'm going to do is the next best thing, and that is suppose that prior to our eon, I'm going to call this our eon, it's not the universe now, the universe is the succession of eons. What we think of, or what we have thought up to this point, I claim, is this thing we think of as the universe is only one eon in an infinite, maybe infinite, I mean it could even be some kind of evolution, you have to think of that possibility, but let's at first say, suggest that this extends indefinitely in both directions, and that you have the Big Bang of each eon matches conformally onto the remote future of the eon before it. So as a conformal manifold, you can go straight through from one to the next. Of course, you do have the singularities in black holes, which give you local termination points of causal curves. But as far as the going backwards, there are no singularities in the conformal geometry. So that is the picture which I'm trying to plug here. It does immediately raise certain questions. One of them is the question which I started off with, namely the second law of thermodynamics. So you might say, how can that be? Because if the entropy is going up all the time, going up and up and up and up, and still going up, how can it keep going up? After all, this was supposed to be addressing that question of the second law. And this thing worried me for quite a while. It seemed to be that it was addressing the second law problem, because you certainly have a constraint. And perhaps I should mention one thing here. I did say that Paul Todd's proposal only meant that the Weyl curvature was finite at the beginning. But when you match it to a remote future, it's much stronger, because the remote future, necessarily, the Weyl curvature goes to zero. And so if it's going to match against the next Big Bang, it can only do so with a Weyl curvature which is also zero in the initial state over here. So this matching that I'm proposing here is something which goes somewhat beyond Paul Todd's proposal, and it does say that the Weyl curvature necessarily is zero at the crossovers. So that's the general picture. What about the second law? Sure, we need that. So let's bring that up. Second law of thermodynamics. How can we square this with a cyclic universe? And one point I should make is that the phase space, the measure on the phase space, is a DP-DQ thing, and that if you scale one up, the other goes down in proportion. So DP-DQ is conformally invariant. So the measure, the Liouville measure on the phase space is not changed when you change the scale. So that's not an answer if you want to think about entropies. In fact, what I claim is the answer has to do with information loss in black holes. I come back to that in just a minute, but let me show you the picture here. This is meant to be phase space now, and as I say, you have a Liouville measure of volume, and we want that if we want to describe entropy, of course. And so what I'm going to do is use Boltzmann's definition of entropy. You imagine your phase space chopped up into coarse graining regions, which are distinguished from each other by the fact that the macroscopic parameters, it's a bit vague, of course, but you say that the macroscopic parameters, things like temperature, chemical composition, pressure, things like that, which give you a general picture of what's going on, these differ from one of these coarse-graining regions to the next, but within one of these regions, they're meant to be the same. And then you take the region that your universe you're looking at the moment is in, and then you see what coarse-graining region does it lie in, what's its volume, that's V, take the logarithm of that, multiply by Boltzmann's constant, and that's the entropy. So I'm using that definition here. Of course, you might worry about this thing coming out infinite, which for an infinite universe, it might well do, but then you can go to some big region, some co-moving region, and do it for that, and it'll work pretty well, so you don't really need to worry about that infinite issue. The fundamental point about the logarithm here is that it makes entropy additive. So the famous, of course, logarithm formula tells you that the entropy for independent systems, since the volumes will multiply, the degrees of freedom will add up and the volumes multiply. So this means that the entropy notion is additive for independent systems. So let me go back to this picture that I have here. Now, what am I doing here? I'm thinking of what happens when a black hole, here we have this picture of a Hawking evaporating black hole, and there is this big argument that people have about information loss. Is information actually lost in a black hole when it evaporates away? And the consensus tends to be, as far as I can make out, that information is not lost, and I can't quite make out how they do that, because to me, once you've got a single, you could have a whacking great big hole here, and nothing much quantum mechanical has happened until you're around about here somewhere, and any information that's got to get regained somehow has got to zip along space-like till it's out here. And, entanglements could be something to do with it, but you've got that information here, which at least is being destroyed, and I just can't make sense of the regaining of information, which indeed was Hawking's original argument, and his argument for the temperature and the entropy came about from making the argument that you did lose information. But then he changed his mind later on for reasons which I've never been able to understand fully. I think the main argument is that you say, well, information loss violates unitarity, and if you're a believer that unitarity has to be preserved at all costs, yes, that would be something to worry about. But in my own case, I'm not, because I think that, after all, measurements violate unitarity and so on and so forth, and I don't believe that that quantum mechanics, as we presently understand it, is in its final form as yet. So I'm not unhappy about information being lost, as it certainly seems as though it should be. And if it is, what happens? Well, you see, because of this formula here, if information gets lost in a black hole, and roughly speaking, when the black hole disappears, you're shrinking your phase space along the directions in which the information is getting swallowed up, and that means your phase space collapses down in this way. Of course, it's different from the usual picture one has about phase space, which is that it's an absolute thing out there, and the dynamics is described just in terms of which curve you take to describe the history. But I'm saying here that when you have information loss, you can't quite do that, and you have to think that after a while, your phase space has effectively become smaller. It's a subtle question, because with black holes, you're never quite sure when this is. It could be gradually, it could be instantaneously, and all these things depend on how you draw space-like surfaces. And so I don't mind that, because it doesn't really enter into the external physics here. as far as the external physics is concerned, because of this formula here, the information which is swallowed by the black hole simply removes one of these terms here, and it simply renormalizes your notion of entropy. So that the entropy, as far as the whole universe is concerned, has been going up and up, yes, and most of it's gone into black holes by an absolutely stupendous factor. So if you get rid of those black holes, entropy, well, the phase space volume that's been swallowed by the black holes, the phase space collapses down by huge factors. It amounts to subtracting off a huge factor from the entropy. It gets renormalized back down to a small value that you have at crossover. And the argument is that at crossover, you basically don't have any entropy increase. It's the major increase has already happened, and the loss due to the phase space volume has already happened. So this is just a smooth transition there. So that's the picture that one has here. Of course, the whole thing, you have to worry about whether it makes sense in all sorts of ways. One point I should make on this transparency, I won't read the whole thing, but this is the scheme here, and there's a point here, you see. You will say, surely, that the Big Bang space-time radii curve should get down to the Planck length, so quantum foam and all these things come in. And you, by you here, I mean all my friends doing quantum gravity. But then I have other friends who do classical general relativity. And the unhappy friends are the ones who say that I'm making a mistake by not doing quantum gravity at the Big Bang, which is what I'm actually basically saying here. And the friends of mine who like to do classical GR are happy because they've got lots of equations they can play with. So let me try and show you some of these equations. That's part of the talk, title of the talk, as far as I can make out. I probably don't have a great deal of time left. How much time do I have, by the way? Okay. I'll run through these equations, then I want to say something about the observational aspects. I'm afraid the equations do need more attention, but let me give you the general ideas. What you have to do is to consider three different metrics, each conformally related to the next one. Here we have the pre-Big Bang metric, and I use a circumflex, a hat, on that. You see, you think of the mnemonic is think of the light cone here, and the piece of the light cone which points downwards, that tells you which metric you're using here. So the pre-Big Bang is the hatted ones, and the post-Big Bang metric, I don't know what you call this thing. I call it a checksumflex, but I have no idea what it's really called. A reverse hat or something. Anyway, there's a third metric, which is the thing I call the bandage, gluing the two together. And this bandage, I'm not putting anything on the top of it. So you do your calculations in this metric here and keep track of the conformal factor, which relates you to this metric and this metric. And so I've got a different colored conformal factors. The big omega is the one that goes to infinity over here that enables you to squash down infinity to make it a finite surface. The little omega is the one which gives you the big bang on the next surface. And I'm putting those things in here. And then we have the Einstein equations with a cosmological constant. I'm assuming the same cosmological constant holds in all three regions. That's not totally an assumption, I think. It depends on how you scale things. In fact, I would like to scale it so the cosmological constant is 3. You might think that's a funny thing to do, but it's actually quite natural. Rather than using Planck units, you can use the speed of light as being 1, Planck's constant over 2 pi. Well, Planck's constant, speed of light is 1, Planck's constant is 2 pi, and the cosmological constant is 3. So that's the idea. I have no idea what kind of units it looks like, but it allows you to have possibly a varying gravitational constant, which is not what I'm saying actually in these eons, but you might think about that. And now you've got the Einstein equations holding, and I'm going to assume also that the matter prior to the Big Bang, prior to crossover, is entirely massless, so that somehow the mass has got lost, and I would agree that this is an approximation. Maybe if the mass does fade out, according to some formula, we would need to know what that formula is. But I'm just supposing that I can get away with assuming that the energy momentum tensor is trace-free prior to the crossover. It turns out that after crossover, you actually grow a trace. And one of the conditions I'm going to put on this is to make that growth of a trace as slow as you can. And we have the scalings for massless material in the pre and post crossover. And we have here the energy momentum tensors. I'm calling the, this is the Einstein tensor here, so it's the trace reversed Ricci tensor. That's right. And here we have the trace-free energy momentum, and here we have something afterwards which actually does grow a trace. Now, I'm going to introduce a thing I call the reciprocal hypothesis, which is that the conformal factors are reciprocals of each other, but with a minus sign, and there's a reason for that minus sign. That makes them positive on both sides. What you expect to find is that in the remote future, the big omega goes smoothly to zero to infinity. So when I say smoothly, I mean in such a way that its reciprocal goes cleanly through zero with a non-zero derivative. So it makes sense to talk about the conformal factor being reciprocal of the other, but since this goes cleanly through zero, it goes to a negative value on the other side. So if you want the conformal factor on the other side to be positive, you need to put minus omega to the minus a half. Now, let me just say a few things here. On the bandage, you need to keep track of the Einstein metric, and so you do that with looking at what the equation for capital omega is, and you see that the equation is this thing I've written down here, which is actually one version of the Calabi equation. What one is looking at is trying to preserve the trace as being the cosmological constant, and that is looked at as a physical equation. This is a self-coupled conformally invariant equation. It's got a cubic, I mean, it's what you might call a phi to the fourth theory, but it's got this coupling in here too with the Ricci tensor to give conformal invariance. In fact, that that equation has lots of nice properties. It's conformally invariant, which says this operator goes into itself and so on. If you look for its energy momentum tensor, that's a thing that used to be referred to as the new improved energy momentum tensor, which you find in various papers. It's an expression which you can write in the following way. I've done it here. And then you see what the Einstein equations are in the pre-Big Bang, the pre-crossover R, and you find that it has this rather nice form, that the energy momentum tensor of the... I'm calling this thing the phantom field. I know that some people have another thing that they call the phantom field. I can't quite think of another name which conveys the same impression. It's not really there, but it's important to keep track of it. So this field is simply telling you the scale factor to go back to the Einstein metric. And if you work out this energy momentum tensor of this phantom field, you find that it's equal to the energy momentum tensor of the matter that's around. And that's the Einstein equations. That's using this expression here. Those are the Einstein equations with cosmological constant. Okay. Now, there's the reciprocal hypothesis. You see, when you bring that in, you find that this equation now tells you that on the other side of crossover, you've suddenly got a real field. That's the striking feature of this thing. I'm afraid I'm having to rattle through this rather fast, so let me do that. The idea here is that you want to have equations which carry you through in a unique way. And there still seems to be some freedom, even when you introduce this reciprocal hypothesis. There's still some freedom, but the freedom amounts to finding solutions of this, what I call the Pomega equation. In Cambridge, I know they refer to this funny pi, wiggly pi, as a Pomega. I use the same terminology here. That Pomega equation is conformally invariant and so on and so forth. And on the other side, because of the reciprocal hypothesis, it turns out to be a field which has contributes positively to the energy momentum tensor. And this is what you have to have in order to keep things positive and so on. If you don't do this, you find on the other side of crossover, you would have effectively a negative gravitational constant, which is, I regard as unphysical here. So that's, if you like, one reason why you have to introduce this reciprocal hypothesis in order to end up with something physical on the other side. And the way to keep track of the conformal factor and everything is to introduce this quantity, a one form, which in terms of the big omega is the omega of omega squared minus one. If you replace big omega by its reciprocal, it goes into itself, and so that means it goes to its negative if you use the little omega. But this pi thing is smooth right across, and in fact, it enables you to reconstruct the conformal factor. There's a formula. I don't know, it's probably not down here. That's it. There is a formula which you can use to reconstruct it, which I've got in another transparency. I think I've got it down here somewhere. Yes, there's a formula here. So it actually does keep track of the information you want, but it keeps track of it in a smooth way. So you go across the crossover, and this capital pi keeps track of the information you need to make sure you can continue your field in a unique way. But the one additional feature I have to introduce is in order to make sure that you don't have a freedom given by solutions of the Pomega equation, you have to decree basically two numbers per point at crossover in order for this equation to have a unique continuation. That's basically the idea. And there are various things you might do. It's quite hard to do something sensible, actually. But what I regard as a sensible thing to do is to take this quantity here, which appears in this equation. There's a thing called mu here, which actually is effectively the trace of the energy momentum tensor on the other side. I guess it appears in this quantity. That's it, yes. It appears over here. These are the massless fields coming through to the other side. This is the energy tensor of the phantom field on the other side, and this is something in addition which picks up this trace. And that trace involves this expression here, and that expression is necessarily vanishes automatically when you're at crossover. That just happens free. But what it doesn't tell you is that it vanishes to third order. If you decree that it vanishes to third order at crossover, that gives you just the right number of conditions that fix the evolution to be unique cross-crossover. So that's what I'm claiming. I should say that there's probably some nice rigorous mathematics that needs to be done here. When I say it's unique, it's basically about counting constants and making sure they look like the right number of things and so on. But there is an issue here to see whether rigorously it really is unique. And that's something that somebody ought to do. If that's the case, that's fine. And you see, this is the same quantity appearing here. And that means that by making this zero to third order, you're putting off the appearance of this rest mass for as long as possible. And then the idea is it does come in when the Higgs field begins to make its roll or something, whatever it is that's going on. And this is one side. And then something analogous to that on the other side would be where the mass decays away in the very remote future. And so that would be the general picture. Now, I probably run out of time, have I? May I take a few moments just to explain the observational situation? I don't hear anybody yelling no. Sorry? Oh, there you are. I'm looking the wrong way. That was clever of me, wasn't it? Yes. Yes, you can't see anything in this light. Hello, yes. Well, let me just explain what we're doing here. What is the most likely, biggest effect that one could see as evidence of a previous eon? Now, the best thing I can think of, well, I have another transparency, which is more or less saying the same thing, is that you have encounters between black holes, and that every now and again they run into each other. Well, we're heading for Andromeda, as I understand it. I don't know whether our black holes are like to encounter each other. Certainly a long time after we're all dead, but that perhaps there will be an encounter and a big burst of gravitational radiation coming out. If you look at the equations, what you find is, well, here I have a picture is what you might see. You see, these things would be like ripples on a pond, and you might see an effect like this, which after the black holes have all disappeared, it's like the rain which has caused these ripples has stopped raining, and you have to try and see whether there were any evidence of individual raindrops having hit the pond. So that's the same thing here. Individual events like this, can you see those? So is there any evidence of this sort of ripple? And you also find that if this is some cluster of galaxies here, that if this one, there's a black hole encounter, then that will happen again several times probably in the same cluster. So you might not just see circular ripples, but you might see concentric circular ripples, which is the idea here. And about getting on for 3 years ago, some people in Princeton were having a look, David Spergel and Amir Hajian were looking for these things. And as it turns out, they probably weren't looking for them in quite the right way. More recently, I've collaborated with Vahe Gurzajan, who has looked at these things in a somewhat different way, which looks much more promising to me. And what he looks for is not either too hot or too cold temperatures, which is what initially I had been imagining, but temperatures which have a anomalously low variance over the ring. So you look for rings where the temperatures are somewhat smoother than you might expect. And he came and showed me with various histograms like this, where these are the temperature variance over rings for a fixed center, looking at larger and larger radii as you move over here. And these dips, he was saying, are some indication that you might be seeing one of these rings. The dips are, this is the variance going up, and so these are low variance indications. And you seem to see them in multiple sets like that. Now, of course, you have to know whether this is statistically significant. And he had a criterion for the statistical significance, which a lot of people have criticized later. And let me just mention the reason for the criticism and something very recent. I should perhaps mention this particular example, which he pointed out to me, where even with the statistics that our critics use, there seems to be a rather significant case here, because you have these two dips, which do have... let me not go into that one particularly, because I want to say something else. See, what people normally do when they want to see what the statistical significance of a thing like this is, they form a simulation of the sky. You look at the real data, and then you look at the simulated data. And the simulation, what they tend to do is put in this power spectrum. So you do a harmonic analysis of the temperature over the sky, and you look for the L value. Now, of course, there are lots of M values as well, but the L value is all you're plotting here, and that gives you what's called the power spectrum. So you plot that out from, say, WMAP, and you get a lot of observed points, and then you compare that with the best theoretical curve, which is the lambda cold dark matter model. And this is one of the triumphs of cosmology, indeed, that at least if you forget the bits down here, you get something which follows the curves very, very nicely. And that's indeed the case. And so then people put in the observed data and say, well, you then look to see if there you see as many circles there as we did originally. And they seem to see about as many. So therefore, they would say they're not really there. They're random effects, which don't mean anything. But then my colleague, Vahe, says, no, they're doing this wrong, because if they're putting this power spectrum in, and if these circles are really there, then the statistical effects of those circles being there will show up in the power spectrum, in the real power spectrum, and therefore you might see too many of them. And he also says, because of general theorems, you would see too many of them. And so therefore he doesn't believe that that's the right thing to do. And we had lots of arguments by email, backwards and forwards, because I wasn't sure that anything he was saying would convince anybody else. Even I was having trouble being convinced, you see. And then the thought occurred to us, why don't you look at these following, well, three things. You look at the actual data and see how many circles there are, and then you look at the data with the power spectrum put in from the observations, and you see something very similar. And then you put in the power spectrum which comes purely from the theory, and then the circles disappear. So what you seem to be seeing is something which is beyond the normal predictions of the standard lambda cold dark matter model, where although these curves hug each other very closely, you'd have to look at where these harmonics are. You see, you're looking way down. I don't know what the values people know, but you're looking at thousands here, whereas the curves fit very well down to somewhere down here, and there's a lot of points off the curve here. And people say, well, that's just noise or something. But whatever it is, you should use the predicted theory power spectrum, not the observed one, because the predicted theory is telling you what theory knows now, and if you don't see the circles in that, then the theory hasn't got the circles in them, whereas the observed data does seem to have the circles in it. Anyway, I better leave you with that, because I'm sure it's going to be controversial. We have an article which we're still preparing and haven't yet put out yet, so we'll see what happens. Thank you very much.
We have time for questions. Please wait till the microphone comes.
The requirement of matching boundary conditions between eons, does that give a prediction for the number of black holes in each eon?
I'm sure there are predictions which could be got out of all this, of that kind. You know, do we get the same number of black holes? I mean, a general sort of requirement of the scheme is a bit like what it used to be for the steady state theory. You want to have something which propagates. So do certain numbers of black holes now that we know in our eon, should we see a similar number in the previous eon? Of course, it might be quite different. But at first, let's assume they're about the same. So you base your calculation on how many black holes we see in clusters of galaxies now. And as far as I can see, it's not unreasonable. But it does need pretty thorough analysis for somebody to do, somebody who's really an expert on looking at galactic dynamics. I have asked people occasionally, you see, experts on this area, and say, how often do you expect to see within a cluster how many black holes will encounter each other in what sort of time period? And they don't usually know the answer to that because they're interested only in encounters that we're likely to see now with LIGO and things like that. And of course, those are I'm thinking of things which take an enormously long time here. So whether there are enough black holes, whether the black holes are going to encounter each other enough, whether possibly galactic clusters evaporate, because you see you're looking at it ridiculously long periods of time, and all sorts of things. You see, if the mass does decay away, then eventually the clusters might disperse. They will also, I mean, they would hold together. They don't partake of the expansion of the universe. They hold together, even with the cosmological constant term. But they would be occasional evaporation of galaxies, presumably, and things like that from clusters, stars from galaxies, and some of these things are very, very long-term events. So there's lots to do. I don't know the answer generally to that question, but it's a good question.
So for a theory to be testable, it needs to have predictions. And the thing that we observe in CMB sky, most notably, is what you just showed, your last slide, which is the CMB power spectrum.
The power spectrum, yeah.
Yeah. So do you have a prediction from your theory for the CMB power spectrum?
No, because I haven't done it. But I think in principle, yes. I mean, in the sense that should there be one, yes. Because one should be able to tell the frequency, I mean, it relates to the previous question. One should be able to tell the frequencies of these black hole encounters. We should be able to tell how much effect they would have. All these things are in the theory. So provided the eon prior to ours is like ours, then in principle, those things are predictable. So, I haven't done it.
So you think all CMB fluctuations just come from black hole encounters?
No, I wouldn't say that necessarily. There will be mass irregularities just from the fact you've got clustering anyway. So there will be more concentrations of mass in some regions than in others. You will also have, and this is very exciting, if this is true, is that Hawking evaporation from a black hole, where does it go? You've got a mass, a great mass there, and it all gets dumped in these photons. So you have a great collection of photons with a very, very specific distribution, which maybe you could pick out of the signal. So that would be very exciting if that could be seen. I don't know how these different effects compare. The energy release in a black hole encounter, of course, is not nearly as much as the Hawking evaporation. That's spread over much longer in time, but it's a more kind of instantaneous effect that one might see just by virtue of the fact that it's a very quick, virtually instantaneous from our point of view. But I think all these things need to be looked at. This is one reason I haven't done it, because it's a big project to work out in detail what kind of CMB temperature variations you would expect on the basis of this theory. Yeah.
One thing that's not clear to me in this picture is what happens to the matter fields. Is the standard model preserved from eon to eon to eon, or does the character of the basic quarks and leptons change from eon to eon? What about issues of baryogenesis, leptogenesis, etc.?
Of course, I mean, these are fundamental questions that, of course, Wheeler used to raise in connection with oscillating models, whether maybe the constants of nature get churned up each time, and that would include presumably be parameters which come into the standard model. So maybe it would be a different type of standard model, or maybe it would be with different quark masses, or goodness knows what. I would just say that I'm going to take the optimistic view here that the physics is the same. Now, it also relates to the anthropic issue. You see, maybe most eons aren't inhabited because these numbers have come out wrong. I've no idea. I would like to say, though, that first try is to assume that the standard model was the same standard model in the previous eon as it is now, with the quark masses the same as they are now, and they come about through maybe some mathematics that we've not discovered yet. If that doesn't work, it doesn't shoot down the whole theory, but it makes the whole theory much more difficult, much less predictive, and much more difficult to know what's going on. So clearly it's a good question. Or perhaps the first number one thinks about is this huge number, sort of what these powers of 10 to the 20, which one seems to see in different phenomena, including the effective scale of the cosmological constant, which is you get the inverse cube of that number.
Well, I ask the question partly because if mass is so diluted at the end of an eon, what mechanism is there to generate anything new when you stick it together with the next eon? I mean, there's
presumably it's all sitting in there. You see, you get mass appearing again. What form does it take is the question.
Yeah.
So I would try to say that the underlying reason for the standard model kicks in again. Maybe some anomalies which come in and break conformal invariance one way or another. I don't know. It's all up for grabs as far as I can see.
But the simplest picture is standard model forever.
That's right. That would be the first thing to try. And if that works, great. If it doesn't work, you've got lots of fallback positions.
More questions?
This is just a technical question, which may not be relevant to what you're saying, but the conformal group of transformations is a 15-parameter group, and the metric covers 10. What about the extra 5?
Yes. The conformal group as such, you see, one's talking about conformal invariance in a somewhat different sense. It's conformal rescaling invariance. So you're changing the metric scale from point to point. To consider the conformal group, of course, you're looking at transformations of basically a conformally flat space. So that conformally flat space, yes, you have a 15-parameter to group. Exactly what role it plays isn't necessarily clear. It's the invariance that I'm talking about here is a a more extensive invariance, because when anyone talks about invariance, say, of the Maxwell equations, often people mean the 15-parameter group, whereas what I mean is a bigger group here, in the sense that it's the group of different scalar fields, if you like, which could be all over the space, with positive value. So these, you could rescale a metric by different amount at every point of the whole four-dimensional space-time. And the Maxwell equations and the Yang-Mills equations with source are conformally invariant in that sense. Of course, when you have quantization, you might worry about anomalies. When you have mass coming in, of course, that will break conformally invariance.
Roger, there's so many questions, but
yes.
Here's one. You also think a lot about quantum mechanics, and you have a view that quantum mechanics is not fundamental, and quantum mechanics
yes.
is an approximation to something else, which involves wave function collapse and so forth. How do those ideas and those issues fit in with this universe that you have now?
Well, I certainly need, even at a sort of basic level, something of that nature, because I'm saying that unitarity has to be violated in the black hole evaporation, the final disappearance of the black hole. So that is appealing to a belief that unitary quantum mechanics is not the whole story. And also that gravity has something to say about what the newer story would have to be. Also, when it comes to the singularities, it takes a view, would I say, that maybe my quantum gravity friends might not like this so much, because I'm rather saying that, you see, one of the reasons for doing quantum gravity, after all, is being, okay, we want to know what's going on in the Big Bang. Okay, and in black holes. Now, basically what I'm saying is that the Big Bang, the curvatures, okay, they reach Planck scale level. I mean, radii of curvature get down to Planck scale level. But I'm waving my hands a bit, but saying that the relevant curvature is not space-time curvature, it's Weyl curvature. And if the Ricci curvature gets down to these 10 to the minus 33 centimeter level, then that doesn't cause a problem to tell us that we need to consider all the wonderful things that people talk about in quantum gravity, where you might have discreteness coming in, you might have loop variable ideas and so on, which, sure, they would be relevant in the black holes. And if you want to understand what's happening there, yes, of course, then the space-time gets messed up completely. But I'm trying to make a very conservative point of view here, saying that the Big Bang, you can be conservative. And, okay, it's not conservative in some respects, but it's very conservative with regard to whether quantum mechanics is playing a big role there. I'm trying to say that we don't need to look at quantum fluctuations in the metric and so on. That's not what's going on. The trouble is, if you allow all these quantum fluctuations, and so, the puzzle has always been, why aren't they all there in the beginning? If you have quantum gravity governing this nature of the Big Bang, you say, why do we simply have this extraordinarily special state and not contributions from all these other things which might be going on? And that's always been a great puzzle to me. But, yeah, there are a whole lot of questions.
Let me just try one last one. Why does conformal invariance ever break? Why does conformal invariance... The universe you have now spends enormous amounts of time in situations which are essentially conformally invariant,
yes.
infinite times,
yes.
punctuated by brief, you know, few billions of years where mass scales matter and time matters.
Of course, you can put the boot on either foot. You can say, talk about years, you see, and then most of the years are in the era when it's basically conformally invariant.
Yeah, so what,
if you talk about conformal time, then it's most of the time is in the conformal breaking time.
No, but why don't we live in a universe which is always in a conformally invariant era?
I think you're asking a too deep question here. I don't know why it is. Sure. No, I think I'm saying that it's not. You see, it never is conformally invariant. It's a little bit like, although perhaps not, but let's say, a little bit like the principle of equivalence. See, the principle of equivalence is the basis of general relativity. But it's not really true, in a sense, because it looks at whether you worry about whether you're looking at derivatives, you see. Do you have a, after all, a gravitational field, unless it's utterly uniform, is not equivalent to an acceleration field, and so on. And when you've got vial curvature, it's not equivalent. So the principle of equivalence is fine as a sort of motivating principle at the beginning, but then you realize pretty quickly that you've got to get around it. I mean, it's not really true in this great sense. Now, here I'm saying also something rather similar, that conformal invariance is a good principle, and not being able to build a clock is how you kind of get across the first step. And then you start to worry about, are other things conformally invariant? Well, they're not. You see, the Einstein equations are telling you, and the cosmological constant, are both telling you in principle you could use these to make a clock. It's just that it's not any kind of practical clock you can make. I have no idea how you'd use the cosmological constant to build a clock, you see. But in principle, okay, you've got conformal breaking, and it's certainly true in the equations. And the equations that I use here are not conformally invariant. So there's you have to look at it sort of in the right spirit, which I'm not quite sure what that is, but yes.
I'm tempted to make a remark about conformal invariance. In private conversations, you know, I was mentioning that we have developed a picture based on conformal symmetry, which apparently is very similar to yours, and it is based on conformal invariance, on local conformal invariance. And the reason you don't see the conformal invariance is only because you choose a gauge. Is by working in a gauge, you don't get to see that there is an underlying conformal invariance. So in that picture, indeed, there is conformal symmetry the whole time as a hidden symmetry. And then a picture which is very similar to what you have described in this lecture, although I have to look a little bit more into your details, it seems to be emerging from a fully conformally invariant theory. And the reason behind that, there is a more fundamental reason for why it is conformally invariant, which goes a lot deeper. It has to do with extra dimensions of time, which can be taken care of also in a gauge invariant manner, so that the theory is fully unitary. So I love your picture. I didn't know about it before, and I'm glad that things seem to be really matching our point of view as well. And I have one question added to this remark. Is that the way that you connect your eons, you let the universe expand, and then after it has expanded, suddenly it reemerges from zero size.
I'm sorry, I missed what you just said.
From zero size. When it begins to expand again, you know, it expands, and then it starts again from zero size, the way you connect them, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in our picture, rather than that, it first expands and then contracts. In other words, there is a time delay. Zero size, and then it starts again. So I'm wondering, this part is a question. I'm wondering whether this would correspond basically to a choice of time, such that this extra time, which is being taken in order to whether in your picture seems to be contracted to zero time, would that be considered possibly as a choice of time?
Well, I think there are different ways you can express this theory. And you mentioned about conformally. You could express this in a conformally invariant form where you have an extra field, basically. In fact, this capital pi gives you, if you have the freedom to allow the field to turn into its reciprocal, and that's something that's like, the capital pi keeps track of that, so that would give you a field which contains the scaling, if you like, and it would be, you could express it in a conformally invariant form. So I think probably this is similar in that respect to what you're saying. It's just that I haven't quite said it in that way. With regard to the question of whether the universe can be considered to collapse, again, it's related to this other question, because, in fact, there's a slight circularity in a way in what I was saying, because if you want to say that the universe continues to expand, as I have in this picture, I'm using a metric which is the one which enables Einstein's equations to be maintained. If you use a different metric, which in some respects you might think is more physical, you say take the mass of an electron to define your clock. Now, the mass of an electron, I'm saying in this scheme, fades away ultimately. So that would give you a time scale in which the I'm not sure it necessarily collapses back, but it will cease in its expansion. And so you reach this crossover in a finite electron time. Now, it may be that proton time or whatever you have, or other particles that might be around, or neutrino time, whichever one you're looking at, electron neutrino time, might be different. And so you've got all sorts of different possible times, and some of those the universe might collapse or expand in different rates. But these will certainly be open to you. Personally, I think that the time you have to use is the one in which Einstein's equations are maintained. And in that time, that time scale, it's an infinite time before crossover. People don't worry about that. So, well, you're waiting to infinity. Well, we're not going to wait to infinity. It's the massless particles, and they don't mind infinity. So you have to have a slightly different point of view to what's going on. It's an infinite time, but it certainly happens sometime in a certain sense. And in the conformal pictures, it's a perfectly clear moment, conformal time, where nothing much happens. You see, you can form your picture right up to the conformal time and across it, probably a little while after it too, without really worrying much about time at all. You could just think about the conformal structure. But, I mean, these things, certainly you can have different point of view depending on what your definition is. And if you use a definition of time, which is, say, based on an electron's mass, then if it the mass fades out, that would be corresponding to a time in which the crossover is reached at a finite electron time. But it wouldn't satisfy the Einstein equations. So you have to worry about what's the best thing to do.
Okay, so perhaps we should finish there. Let's thank Roger once again.